afternoon. I've had the really good fortune of visiting Ireland and Northern Ireland a number of times previously. I've visited Dublin and Limerick and Galway and Belfast and Derry. I've even been around the Ring of Kerry and been to the Giant Causeway in the Dingle Peninsula. So I've seen a few things, very touristy, I know, but I've also worked with teacher educators at many of the institutions in your countries, and I've taught twice research methods courses at St. Patrick's campus of DCU. And I've attended one previous SCOTUS conference in 2005, so where I spoke about standards and accountability by invitation. So Ireland, Northern Ireland, and SCOTUS have had a special place in my heart as a really unique organization for some time. So my thanks to Noel Purdy and the organizing and planning committees for this conference for including me in this important topic about leadership. I also want to thank Connor Galvin, who's become my travel companion to and from the Dublin Airport. Well, we've only done two. We have to do the other part coming up. But since our time today is limited, I really want to jump right into the presentation. I've been invited to talk today about democratic accountability in teacher education. And I want to note that my talk today draws on my recent book, Reclaiming Accountability, which I co-authored with 8 former doctoral students. And for the doctoral students that I met this morning, they're all finished, they all have PhDs. Some of them are in that picture, and I'm very proud of them. One other note, especially in the first part of this talk, I'm going to use examples from the US teacher education context, which is, of course, not the same as the context here. But we live in a globalized society wherein teacher quality has been the focus of intense scrutiny for nearly 3 decades. And as I've had a chance to share some of these ideas in many places around the world, people seem to have been able to find places where what I'm saying resonates, although there are also important differences. And I trust that you will be able to do the same kind of thing. My talk this afternoon has 3 parts. In part 1, I'm going to present a framework for sorting out and analyzing multiple overlapping accountability initiatives. And then I'm going to use that framework to argue that in the US and some other places, there is a dominant accountability paradigm that's consistent with neoliberal ideology and top-down monitoring. In part two, I'm going to propose an alternative that we have labeled democratic accountability in teacher education, and I'm going to use the same framework to talk about that. And then finally, in part 3, I'm going to describe a number of promising practices related to accountability and raise some questions about their feasibility. And in that 3rd section, I'm going to concentrate as well on leadership issues. So let me go right to part 1. In the US and in some other countries, there are currently multiple overlapping teacher education accountability and other kinds of regulatory policies and initiatives. So to sort this out, that group of folks you saw there, and I'm going to say we, and that's who I'm referring to sort all that out, we developed an 8-dimensional accountability framework. Those dimensions are values, purpose, concepts, what we call the diagnostic dimension, the prognostic dimension, control, content, and consequences. Now, these dimensions cluster together to constitute larger themes and issues in accountability. So the first 3 dimensions, values, purpose, and concepts, form a cluster that has to do with the foundations of accountability, or the underlying ideas, ideals, aims, and ideologies. The next 2, the diagnostic and the prognostic dimension, form a cluster that we call the problem of teacher education. And this has to do with how teacher education gets conceptualized and framed as a particular kind of policy and practice problem, as well as how solutions get framed and often operationalized. The last three dimensions, control, content, and consequences, form the cluster power relationships in accountability. This really gets at politics. So this has to do with what expectations and evidence for claims are stipulated, who has the authority to stipulate them, whom they affect, and both the short and long-term consequences and implications of accountability policies. Now, the contribution of this framework, I think, is that you can use it to unpack the assumptions behind almost any teacher education accountability policy. And we've actually found that you can use it to unpack a lot of other teacher education and teacher quality policies as well, whether or not they have explicitly to do with accountability. Once you've unpacked these assumptions together, they reveal the theory of change underlying teacher education policy and their consistency or not with the larger democratic project, which is what I'll get to in a while. So we used this framework to try to sort out and analyze teacher education accountability in the U.S. To do this, we identified four of the most widely publicized, highly politicized, and influential current national accountability policies and initiatives. And I'm going to give you just a very quick review of them because I know they're different from what you have here. But you have to kind of understand these. So in the U.S., every one of the 50 states has its own accountability standards for evaluating and approving teacher education programs. But starting in about 1998 in particular, there's been a tug of war between the states and the federal government for control. In 2014, the federal Department of Education proposed very controversial new federal reporting requirements that would hold every individual teacher education program accountable for the impact of its graduates based on the test scores of their eventual students. So you kind of have to get your head around that. We will evaluate teacher education programs based on the test scores of the students in the schools who are taught by the graduates of those programs. These reporting requirements were finally approved in the U.S. in 2016 at the end of the Obama administration, but then rescinded in 2017, almost immediately, by the Trump administration. There's obviously a lot more to say about that, but I'll leave it at that. So that's the first form of accountability, but that's not all. In addition to state and federal standards for accountability, there's a national professional accreditor of teacher education programs, and this is called the Council for the Accreditation of Educator Preparation, or CAPE. And some of you, depending on your age, are familiar with its predecessor, NCAPE. So this is like the latest version of NCAPE. CAPE has a set of standards that in certain ways resemble the federal requirements I was just talking about. All teacher education institutions that want to be nationally, professionally accredited are accountable to these standards. But there's still more. Beginning in 2013, a private advocacy organization with no regulatory or professional standing, the National Council for Teacher Quality, or NCTQ, began grading U.S. teacher education programs A through F according to their own standards, which were never professionally vetted, and reporting these in highly publicized U.S. News and World Report special editions, and then later on their own widely disseminated website. There were some surprising results from this grading. You may have heard of a little place called Stanford University, for example, or Teachers College at Columbia University, the teacher education programs at both of those institutions were graded by NCTQ with a D, D as in dog. Finally, there is also a major trend across many of the US states to require teacher candidates to pass a teacher performance assessment in order to be licensed as teachers. The biggest of these is the EdTPA, which holds teacher candidates accountable to another set of standards regarding classroom performance. And this is now in place in many of the states, not all, but in many of the states. You can see why we had to figure out a way to sort all of this mess out a bit. So to analyze these initiatives, we collected and coded hundreds of policy documents and tools, position statements, critiques, media postings, and a lot that go with these four initiatives. So you can see the four initiatives down the left, and then we used our framework, which is across the top, and we worked at the cluster level that I was just talking about, and to look across the four. We found some differences, but we also found enormous similarities. We found core similarities and cross-cutting themes that collectively constituted what we called a dominant accountability paradigm. And I'm going to tell you just a little bit about what that looked like. So in terms of the core foundations, we found two pervasive values: market ideology on one hand and equity on the other. Now, you're going to see in a moment that these seemingly incompatible values actually aren't, given a particular view of equity. Market ideology can be summarized in three words: teachers matter most. They matter most in students' achievement and in a country's international competitiveness, words that were echoed relentlessly across the globe for many years. The logic behind this market ideology is very consistent and, I'm guessing, very familiar. Here's how the logic goes. We live in a global knowledge society. This means a country's economic competitiveness depends on its human capital. It's a country's education system that produces that capital. And it's a country's teachers that determine the quality of the education system. If student achievement isn't world class or is uneven across socioeconomic, ethnic, language, or racial groups, it's assumed to be the failure of teachers and of teacher education programs. Some of the many problems with that set of assumptions is reflected in the overarching goal of equity. Now, many of us in this room, I think, agree with the goal of equity, and I could ask you all to raise your hands. But when we looked beneath the surface of the rhetoric of these accountability policies by really looking at the discourse, it was clear that most US accountability initiatives were animated by what we came to call thin equity rather than strong equity. That is, they worked from the dual assumptions that the unequal distribution of effective teachers is the major cause of educational and social inequity. And they also assumed that increasing the distribution of effective teachers would achieve equity without necessarily addressing the social and economic structures and systems that create and perpetuate inequity in the first place. Strong equity, which I'll say more about in part two, assumes the exact opposite. This notion of thin equity is really powerful because it's not called thin equity, it's just called equity. So these various initiatives and accountability policies seem to address equity, but what they do, in fact, is to mask the systems and structures that produce and reproduce inequity. Let me move now to the second set of dimensions, the problem of teacher education. With the dominant accountability paradigm in the US, the problem of teacher education is constructed as the result of two major failures. Teacher education's failure to earn public confidence and trust as a profession, and its failure to develop a system of continuous improvement based on systematic data about impact and performance. As we read the materials about all of these initiatives, we were astounded to see how often data was mentioned, and data systems, and continuous use of data, data analytics, large-scale data, and so on and so on. Policy analyst Deborah Stone says that policy problems usually have narrative structures complete with identifiable heroes, villains, and victims. She says policy stories are powerful because they persuade people both how to understand a problem and what to do about it. In the US, the dominant policy narrative about teacher education has generally gone like this. The pervasive low level of teacher quality threatens national economic security. The cause of poor teacher quality is poor teacher preparation. Policymakers and the public rightly mistrust teacher education because programs don't have reliable, universal, standard performance data. The situation is dire. But wait, the story continues. We now have the technology to control the problem with rigorous national data systems, cutting-edge assessment tools, and sophisticated data analytics. With these, the problem of teacher education can be controlled. Good programs will rise to the top, while bad ones will be identified based on the data and can be excluded. Across the discourse about the major accountability initiatives in the US, we found that the policy narrative was remarkably consistent. The villain was teacher education programs because they didn't have the strong data systems required to become a true profession. The victims were school children and the public. And the hero was whichever policy or initiative would monitor and control the situation through data. And all four of these national initiatives would set up or have set up large-scale national data systems. The third part of the dominant accountability paradigm has to do with who does or who should have power and control over teacher education. A number of scholars have talked about internal and external accountability to get at whether the group in charge is internal or external to the group being held accountable. Here, there are also matters of voice and choice, whether the groups being held accountable have a voice about standards and mechanisms for control, and whether they have the opportunity to choose to participate or not. With deep mistrust of teacher education in the US, it's no surprise that we found that control tends to be external to both the institutions being evaluated and the profession itself, with little voice or choice about participation. That's a whirlwind tour of the US. This brings me to part two, an alternative to the dominant accountability paradigm. Now, to elaborate this, I'm going to use the framework again now that I've spent some time teaching it to you. With the dominant accountability paradigm, as I said, the foundations were market ideology and thin equity. With democratic accountability, the values are derived from democratic theory and the notion of strong equity. democratic education theory draws on thinkers like many of those pictured here. A basic assumption is that in democratic societies, teaching and teacher education are values-oriented enterprises for the public good, rather than market-oriented enterprises based on competition for private goods. Democratic accountability assumes that we need participatory, community-oriented forms of democracy in Benjamin Barber's classic sense of strong democracy. Here it's assumed that there is something called the public interest, and there is something called the common good that is more than and different from the sum of people's individual self-interest. Now, there's way more to say about this as well, but I'm going to go on and just give you the flavor of this. In addition to strong democracy, the foundations of democratic accountability in teacher education are also based on strong equity, which has four core ideas, as we have conceptualized it, drawing especially on the work of Nancy Fraser, Ken Howe, Joyce King, and other political philosophers who have theorized justice and theorized equity. First is the idea of the redistribution to all schools of teachers who are committed to working for social change and who know how to teach students not only literacy and numeracy skills, although those are critical, but also how to advocate for themselves, how to engage in democratic deliberation, how to disagree respectfully with others. Second is recognition by teachers, by school leaders, and policymakers of the school and societal structures and systems that reproduce inequity. This means it's not going to take just policy about teacher education and teacher quality to change and interrupt inequality, but it will also take policies related to housing, jobs, transportation, healthcare, and early childhood services. This also includes recognition and representation of the values and knowledge traditions of minoritized communities in the school curriculum and in the school's practices and in their policies. Third is the idea of reframing. Reframing powerful frames related to equity, especially ideas like the frame of colorblindness, the frame of meritocracy, which assume objectivity and mask the structural, economic, and racialized nature of inequality within a discourse of individualism and equal access. Finally, is the idea of resolving tensions. This has to do with acknowledging the inherent tensions and contradictions among competing ideas about equity and managing these concretely on the ground, although not perfectly, in local teacher education programs. Next, with the dominant accountability framework, as I hope I made clear, the problem of teacher education has consistently been framed as the failure of teacher education to produce a competitive workforce because of the lack of data systems and the mistrust of the public. But from the perspective of democratic accountability, we would argue that the major problem is the dominance of the accountability paradigm itself and its negative effect on teacher education and teaching. From the perspective of democratic accountability, the problem of teacher education is the subtractive impact of the dominant accountability paradigm. In the US, this dominant paradigm has prompted uniformity and compliance. It's redefined how teacher educators think about their work. It's emphasized narrow performance outcomes. It's de-emphasized local knowledge and communities. And it's reduced the spaces in teacher education for discussion and action related to equity, social justice, and democratic education. With the policy narrative that supports democratic accountability, the villain, or at least one of the villains, is the dominant accountability paradigm itself. And the hero is certainly not more data, but the collective. That is, teacher educators working with each other across boundaries and working with teachers, families, communities to change the focus of accountability. This cannot be done by teachers and teacher educators alone, but it also can't be done without them. The third aspect of democratic accountability has to do with power relationships, especially control. Here we propose the concept of intelligent professional responsibility in teacher education, which is derived from three ideas: intelligent accountability, new internal-external accountability relationships, and the distinction between responsibility and accountability. Honora O'Neill suggested that what she and some others had called the audit culture in the UK public sector had resulted in the lack of motivation, mistrust, and no actual improvement in people's work. She called instead for intelligent accountability that begins with trust and with the audacious idea that the people who do the work in a particular area actually know something about it and generally want to do it better. The second idea, new internal-external relationships. This was elaborated by Michael Fullan and his colleagues in relation to K-12 education. They said that in order to support teachers' learning and students' learning in the schools, external policymakers should concentrate on creating the conditions for strong internal and local accountability for students' learning, rather than just monitoring and auditing. Finally, is the distinction between responsibility and accountability. This has to do with the notion of obligation and imposition. Responsibility is chosen. Accountability is imposed. We combined these ideas and developed and worked them out together and applied them to teacher education. Intelligent professional responsibility in teacher education is based on the dialogue and participation of all stakeholders in the teacher education enterprise, including the participants of local teacher education institutions and programs who are being held accountable, and their students, the families and communities that they work with. Dialogue, inclusion, and deliberation are key here. Intelligent professional responsibility leads to heightened trust and enhanced professionalism. And it also leads to deep rather than superficial responses to evaluation when people are trying merely to comply. This brings me to part three, promising practices and the challenges of leadership. So far, I've been talking about democratic alternatives to teacher education accountability, but I've been talking about it in theory. We need to do more than that. So in part three, I want to briefly describe some innovative programs, networks, and policies that I think suggest promising directions for democratic accountability in practice. Now, you're going to see that each example is in sync with one or more of the dimensions of democratic accountability that I've just been talking about, such as strong equity or intelligent professional responsibility. But none of them is consistent with all of the dimensions. This is a work in progress. For each example, I'll say also a little about leadership. The leadership it took to create the example and the challenges for educators that go with each one. So I want to share 6 promising practices and say something about the kind of leadership is involved and what leadership challenges these pose. So if you look sort of at the right half of this screen, I'm going to talk about local programs, scaling up from the local, a state-level consortium, a dean's organization, and 2 countrywide teacher education reforms. So first, our efforts to democratize teacher education at the level of local programs. So as I've shown, accountability expectations in the U.S. are determined and monitored by multiple agencies external to local programs. But even with this, there are teacher educators in some individual programs who have worked to democratize knowledge and content or to make democratic education the centerpiece of the curriculum. For example, with the Schools Within the Context of Community program at Ball State University, that's in the state of Indiana, community mentors help teacher candidates learn about the funds of community knowledge in children's lives outside of school, and that becomes part of their training as teacher candidates. At the University of Washington, some teacher education programs now have field placements, not just in schools, but also in community-based organizations. They have now a community family politics program, and that strand is intended to shift power relationships by incorporating the knowledge of community members and families as co-teacher educators. A special teacher education program at Lesley University requires teacher candidates to position the autistic students they work with as equals in the community, and candidates are evaluated on their ability to factor student voice into placement, program, and service decisions to align with the goals of democratic education. And finally, at UCLA, teacher candidates are expected to be activists, and they're evaluated on their mastery of activist skills in working with immigrant families and other minoritized communities. The leadership for each of these programs came at the individual level, a single teacher educator or a small group with a good idea and a really strong commitment to democratic goals, and also the willingness to build relationships with communities. The leadership challenge, of course, is the other side of that same coin, how to move beyond local pockets of reform and move beyond the committed individual or small group who has a good idea. Now, my second example actually speaks to that. As I've said, most teacher education reforms include equity as a goal, but if you look beneath the surface, most are consistent with thin equity. One example of a program with strong equity goals is the National Exceptional Teaching for Disadvantaged Schools program. This began at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. Part of the impetus for this was that they wanted to directly reject the Teach for Australia program that had made its way into Australia. And you know that, like Teach for America and Teach for many, many, many other countries, these programs tend to recruit top performing college students with no preparation in education. So here's what they did at Queensland University. They recruited top performing teacher education students to work long term alongside teachers and families in historically marginalized, very high poverty communities in rural and urban Australia. In this program, very unlike Teach for Australia, the teacher candidates took extensive coursework that rejected individualistic and access-based definitions of equity. Now, perhaps this sounds, again, like one person's good ideas, and it is, but this local program scaled up to 7 universities, supported by funding from the government and from private foundations. The funding was forthcoming because the leaders of the program collected evidence that the program had increased the number of high-achieving teacher candidates who chose to teach and chose to stay in high-poverty and lower-performing schools. This program has now been carried along and revised into a new program by Joe Lampert, one of its co-founders, at La Trobe University in Victoria, Australia, where it's now called the Nexus Program. The leadership challenge here was turning on its head what it meant to recruit high-achieving students into teaching and what it meant to measure outcomes. Here, outcomes included the commitment to teaching and staying in high-poverty schools. The really savvy aspect of this leadership, in my view, was very careful documentation of something that was important that could be counted to persuade policymakers who like counts, right? Of the need for funding of these programs. And it's going very strong now. Here's a third promising practice. This is from the state of New Hampshire in the US. New Hampshire is a very small state. The 13 institutions that had teacher education programs in New Hampshire joined together into a group they call the New Hampshire Institutions of Higher Education Network. The group was formed and is now run by teacher educators themselves. They worked explicitly to put aside competition, to build trust, and to get to know each other's programs while working collegially to influence policymakers and engage practitioners. One of the consortium's key accomplishments was the development and statewide use of the New Hampshire teacher candidate assessment of performance. They explicitly rejected a single measure, high stakes, top down, and externally controlled state policy, such as those that are in place in many states in the US. The leaders here were teacher educators from every institution in the state who essentially took accountability back. The group concluded that high-stakes mandated performance assessments grounded in competition rather than collaboration undermined the formative benefits of performance assessment and then positioned teacher educators as reactive rather than proactive. So they collaboratively negotiated a new kind of approach. I think the leadership challenge here hinges on the tension between collaboration and critique. The 13 institutions have collaborated closely with one another, partly by avoiding competition and avoiding critique of each other's programs. But there's room for critique. And there's a need for critique. So I think the challenge now for this group is to develop collaborative and democratic critique. Here's another promising practice. Founded in 2016, the Education Deans for Justice and Equity, note that the acronym is EDGE, this is a nationwide alliance of deans and former deans of education of ed schools or faculties of education. Their goal is to advance equity and justice in education by speaking collectively and in solidarity with communities regarding policies, reform proposals, and public debates. You can probably tell from what I've said already, this perspective is not the dominant perspective in the US. So this is a group that is operating to a certain extent on the margins and trying to resist what is going on. They published one of their first acts was to publish a letter signed by more than 200 deans and former deans, but we have a lot of deans in the U.S. This was published in the New York Times, challenging the Times editorial that had praised proposed federal teacher education reporting regulation. Edge's letter said the Times editorial was based on rhetoric, not research, and that the editorial presumed, without evidence, that teacher education programs were mediocre and underperforming. In short, they claimed that the Times was, intentionally or not, contributing to a manufactured crisis. Edge argued that when we treat teacher education as a competitive marketplace fueled by privatization, we set up a system that ensures that some win while others lose. So the Dean's Group's explicit goal is to try to reframe the public debate about education and teacher education with equity and justice at the center. There's another Dean's Group, a rival group founded the same year called Deans for Impact, who has a very different viewpoint, and you can guess from the term that their focus is not equity and justice, but bottom line performance. Promising practice number 5 comes from Norway, where as of 2017, a national reform requires that all teacher candidates for primary and lower secondary schools must earn a master's degree and do a master's thesis. The Norwegian Agency for Quality Assurance in Higher Education is called NOKUT. It's the group that's responsible for evaluating the implementation of the reform and for auditing compliance. In an unprecedented move, NOKUT established an international advisory panel, which I have had the opportunity to chair, to help ensure that this teacher education reform was successful and that Norway's teacher candidates and its school children received the best education possible. I wish I could say that the advisory panel and NOKUT together had the wisdom to do this from the beginning, but over time, we developed an approach that has to a great extent reinvented NOKUT's role from an external auditor and a compliance monitor to an external agency that is working with teacher education institutions to create the conditions for strong internal accountability. So over 3 years, and our 3 years are rapidly coming to an end, our work was participatory and collaborative, inclusive, and rather than a compliance-oriented approach, it was intended to be agency-centered, empowerment-centered, and enhancing the research capacity of teacher education institutions. So we made a point not to tell the higher education institutions what to do. We tried to create the conditions wherein together they figured out what to do, learned from each other, and did what was appropriate in their local context. Finally, the last promising practice is from one of your neighbors. I was recently invited to write an article about teacher education reform in Wales for a special issue of the Wales Journal of Education. I didn't really know very much about teacher education reform in Wales. So to do this, I reviewed many of their materials and then used the accountability framework that I've been presenting this afternoon to organize my response. Now, Wales is no exception to the larger international trend in that its approach to reforming teacher education is a new set of accreditation criteria to which all teacher education programs at universities are now being held accountable. But here's what I found really interesting and promising. Despite Wales saying explicitly that their performance on international assessments was mediocre, the reformed Wales accreditation system reflects an ideology less focused on the expectation that teachers' jobs is to prepare the workforce for the competitive global economy and more focused on the need for teachers to prepare competent, well-rounded, engaged, and principled young people ready to live and work productively in society. In other words, the foundation of the Wales new accreditation requirements lean more toward the educational discourse of UNESCO and other humanist organizations, and lean less toward the educational discourse of OECD and other economic organizations. Wales is not the only country with goals like these, of course, I think you know. But Wales' goals are very different from the dominant approach in the US, I think it's fair to say England, and other outcomes-based accountability system. The new Wales initial teacher education system also requires joint responsibility for teacher education. The schools and the universities are supposed to share that. I think the leadership challenge here involves the tension between imposition and agency. Even when the goals are worthy, humanist and learner-centered, rather than market-driven, if those goals are experienced by teacher education institutions as top-down and imposed, then they're difficult to sustain. And requiring shared responsibility for teacher education, universities and schools, doesn't necessarily mean that the resources are in place to sustain that. You remember that the title of this presentation is Democratic Accountability in Teacher Education. If there were a subtitle, I think it might be The Need for Leadership Now More Than Ever, which I want to say just a few words about in conclusion. In the US, we have a lot of problems, including a president who shows no interest in issues related to equity and justice, or, I must say, issues related to democracy. But we have bigger problems and deeper fault lines that are not unique to the US, and although dramatically exacerbated by, were not invented or introduced by Trump. Across many developed countries, we have growing and, in some cases, intergenerational income inequality and serious gaps between historically privileged and disadvantaged groups in educational opportunities and outcomes. We have the emergence of a strong conservative nationalism. We have a backlash against immigrants and immigration policies. And we have the acute polarization of people who are animated by deeply dissimilar values, including some people whose values are defined by intolerance, even hatred, of conflicting viewpoints and those who hold them. Now more than ever, we need leadership at all levels for democratic education and democratic accountability, which I think are indispensable to the future of our democracies. Now, before I disappear, I want to be very clear that I am not suggesting we reject accountability at any level of education, but rather that we reinvent it, consistent with the democratic project. In short, I'm proposing that we reclaim accountability at all levels of leadership, from the individual to the collective power of consortiums of individuals, to the leaders of faculties and schools, to regulatory agencies and ministries of education. That we see all of these levels as potential levers for reconstructing teacher education's targets, purposes, and consequences, and reclaiming them for democratic education and equity. Now, I'm using the word reclaim here very deliberately. Many definitions of the word focus on the idea of retrieving or getting something back that was previously lost, like reclaiming the throne, or that was temporarily separated from the owner, like reclaiming your luggage. But definitions of reclaiming also include the idea of rescuing something from an undesirable state, or reforming something from wrong or improper conduct. My use of reclaiming to talk about accountability is closest to this last sense. I explicitly want to rescue teacher education accountability from its current immersion in market ideology and the human capital paradigm. I want to rescue teacher education accountability for democratic education, which not only prepares students for participation in democratic deliberation, but also identifies and works to eradicate the structures and systems that produce and reproduce inequity. In closing, then, let me be clear. I take the stance that accountability should serve democracy, not the market. And I think we as educators, no matter what our own sphere of influence, should work within and beyond those spheres to take leadership to remake teacher education together. Thank you. Not bad. All right.
Okay, thank you so much to Marilyn for a really stimulating presentation. We started late, so I think it's only fair to allow some time for questions and discussion, and if necessary, we can have a slightly shorter refreshment break or start our next session slightly later as well. Now, I see that we have two roving mics. There's one over here with Anthony and one over here with Tricia. So I'm going to throw it open for a few moments to the floor, and we have one hand up already. So any questions for Marilyn? Thank you.
Hi, my name's Jonathan Worley. I'm an American, by the way. And I suppose my basic question is, where did it all go wrong? Because I'm 63 now. I grew up...
I'm not hearing you.
Let me try again. Is this better? I'm an American. I grew up in an educational system in the 60s where I felt democracy, participation were encouraged and developed, and you know, the growth of the individual citizen. And we studied American history in terms of, you know, the founding fathers seeing education as crucial to the establishment of a working democracy. And I just wonder, where do you think it all began to go wrong?
Well, the answer is probably a really long, really complicated answer, depending on how far back you want to go. But I think that many analysts and historians have talked about the Nation at Risk report that was published in 1983 as the beginning of the emergence of a policy paradigm. It's that concept is very similar to what I've talked about as teacher education as a policy problem, with the idea being that we can address educational issues and problems through competition. We can make schools compete with one another. The market will decide which approaches are most appropriate. So I think a lot of the what has become a neoliberal market approach didn't start out with that label, but it has resulted in the commodification of education, competition among schools, competition among teacher education programs, letting the market decide how all of this will turn out, without, I think, enough attention to the fact that the same groups that were left behind before we had No Child Left Behind in 2001, the same groups that were left behind continue to be left behind. And new immigrant groups emerge in those left behind groups as well. So, I mean, that's one way to identify the problem starting then. And this isn't to say that there aren't pockets of reform and places where they're doing wonderful, fabulous things in the public schools and where traditionally minoritized groups have had wonderful success. But that's not the norm. And I think until we get much, much further along that road, we have to work on those things. So that's one way to talk about where this began, I think.
Any other comments or questions? Time for another one or two comments. Teresa?
Marilyn, thank you for a fascinating explanation of thin equity and strong equity and the issue of the teacher problem, teacher education problem. In Ireland, we're very blessed, particularly in the South, not to have a teacher education problem, but many of our policymakers seem to think we do have a teacher education problem and continuously bring out new ideas, policy documents, criteria that now become standards to try and control teacher education. That level of external control is increasing all the time, and there seems to be less and less trust in the system. And I suppose just what your comments might be for us who are not where you are at the moment, but we're certainly on a longer trajectory in that route.
Was there a question?
Well, the question is what advice you might give to us in addressing something that is creeping towards less trust and greater levels of control.
Well, I would say don't do what we've done. In Australia, they are becoming more and more accountability centered. No, they're not where we are in the US or where England is, but I think there are places. Chile has emerged with a lot of the same accountability kinds of foci. So I would say don't do that. And I think one thing, if I understand the scene correctly, and I might not, but I think one thing that I have always noticed about Ireland and Northern Ireland is respect for the teaching profession. For a long time, it was among the most popular areas for people to enter. Is that still true? Okay. So I think trying to maintain trust of the profession is a really important thing. And trying to say that in order to reform, we need enhanced professionalism and greater trust of the profession rather than the opposite. One thing I would say absolutely is to hold the line on new providers. We have in the US an enormous number of new providers of teacher education now. Some of them do good programs. I'm not saying they're all bad at all, but the role of the university in teacher education in the US and with it, the role of research in teacher education, it has really eroded over the last 20 years, so that we now have many, many new programs. I'm doing this study of what we are calling new graduate schools of education. These are teacher education programs within new organizations that are organized and labeled as graduate schools of education. They've been authorized by their states to prepare teachers, so it's not like Teach for America when we just sort of put people in. They actually prepare teachers. They grant master's degrees, and they are not connected to universities. So this is a really big, different kind of development. This is these new organizations laying claim to professional ground that has been long the territory of universities. England now has some of these as well that I believe, according to my colleague Viv Ellis, who's studying some of these, some of them are patterned after the ones in the US. So as I say, all of these are not doing bad programs. Some of them are doing some really pretty interesting things. But it's a big change to dislocate teacher education from colleges and universities and to dislocate it from the knowledge traditions of universities and the sources of knowledge of universities. And these new organizations use the nomenclature of universities, which I think is very interesting. So they call themselves graduate schools of education. They have deans. Some of them have provosts. I don't know if you use provost in Ireland, but it's a term we use in the US. So I would say hold really hard and fast to the idea of the importance of the profession, trusting the profession, and not blocking out any other possibility. I don't think that's a smart thing to do, but I think carefully thinking about the impact that new providers can have, and maybe working with those groups right from the beginning so that there could be a lot of attention to what is the nature of teacher preparation? How is it conceptualized? How is it enacted at these new places? I don't know if that will work or if that will stop anything, but I think it's worth a lot of attention and consideration.
Okay, time for another question or another comment, I think. Jacqueline?
Thank you very much. One of the things I'm curious about is where the students themselves are located within the particular circumstances that you've described, whether there is a student voice, I suppose, in that space. I know that is not really on the leadership end of things, but so I'm not sure if you could say something about that.
Whether there's a student voice in accountability?
Yes, or whether there is some sort of maybe a reaction or a discourse among students.
So I'm assuming that when you say students, you mean the teacher candidates who are students. Well, it's interesting. In some places, there has been a fair amount of student resistance to some of these new accountability measures. With the EdTPA, which was one of the ones that I had up there, that was developed initially by researchers at Stanford in their education area. And then along the way, as it became bigger and bigger and became a national accountability tool, the responsibility for managing data and administering and managing the test itself was contracted out to Pearson. Some of you know, yeah, that Pearson. At that point, there was a lot of resistance and response to EdTPA and the kind of accountability perspective that it represented. There was one institution where the teacher candidates working with their instructor refused to send their test in for scoring. The instructor eventually lost her job. This was very controversial, and it was in my state in Massachusetts. There have been a number of articles and critiques written of CAPE new standards and the fact that although CAPE claims to be an organization by and for and of the profession, it is actually experienced by most teacher education programs as imposed, as top-down, as mandated. So there's been reaction there. There have been a number of articles. When we were writing this book, and it finally went to press, I think, at the end of 2017, right in that final year, a whole lot of new articles emerged about EdTPA and CAPE, where individual institutions were studying their own experience with these new accountability measures and talking about them as not being of and for the profession and what it meant for their work with students. I would say teacher educators were more the impetus for that than teacher candidates themselves, but teacher candidates played a role. There's also been reaction from teacher candidates in terms of the cost of some of these. So the EdTPA, the teacher performance assessment, is quite pricey to take that exam, and in many states now require it for certification. So there's been pushback in terms of who can afford to do this and who can afford to do any kind of preparation. There also have been some studies that indicate that women do better on these tests than men, that people who are English first language folks do better than people whose first language is not English. So, I mean, there's been a lot of pushback along those lines that is related to students, not necessarily led by students, I don't think.
Okay, I think I'm going to call things to a halt just there. It's just approaching 3 o'clock, and we're slightly behind schedule, but I think I'm going to make an executive decision here and say that we'll have our refreshments. I think that's the dominant paradigm of the next 30 minutes, really, is caffeine. So let's break for coffee from 3 to 3:30. So instead of 3:15, we're going to start the parallel sessions at 3:30. Details are on the program. There are 4 venues, including this one, for those presentations. You should have registered and chosen your session already. But on your behalf, could I finish just by expressing my sincere gratitude to Marilyn for coming all this way and for such a stimulating presentation. Thank you especially for giving us those promising practices to encourage us as well that all is not lost, either in the US or around the world. It's been a really interesting presentation. Food for thought, lots of discussion, I'm sure, over the next 24 hours as well. So thank you again. Let's show our appreciation for our presentation.